So, Menelaus, your heart warmed within you. And he said simply, "Now, Antilochus, I will put away my anger gladly, for you were never perverse or light-minded before. Just for once, boydom was too much for wisdom. Another time, don't try to overreach your betters. Not everyone, let me tell you, could have made me change my mind. But you indeed have suffered much and worked hard for my sake, and so have your excellent father and brother. Then I will grant your petition, and I will make you a present of the mare, which is my own, that all these here may know that my temper is not tyrannical and harsh." So saying, he gave Neomen the mare to lead away, and took the cauldron himself. Meriones took the 2 ingots of gold in the 4th place as he came in forth. The 5th prize was left over, the 2-handled bowl. This Achilles carried through the company, and gave it to Nestor, saying, "Here, venerable prince, you shall have something too. Let it be a treasure for you in memory of the burying of Patroclus, for you will see him no more in this world. I give you this prize for nothing. You will not box for it, or wrestle, or cast a javelin, or run a race. Already the years are heavy upon you." He placed the bowl in Nestor's hands, and Nestor received it with pleasure, and said with great simplicity, Aye,
my boy, that's true enough. My joints are not what they were, my dear boy, nor my feet. My hands do not shoot out from the shoulders right and left, touch and go. Ah, if I were young and strong as I was once, when the Epeans were burying my lord Amarynceus in Buprasium, and his son set up prizes in the king's honour, there wasn't a man to match me, not an Epean, not a Pylian, not an Aetolian of them all. In boxing I beat Clitomedes, Enop's son. In wrestling, Pleuronian Ancaeus, who stood up to me. I outran Iphiclus, though he was a good man. With spear I overshot both Phileus and Polydorus. I only lost with the horses. There the 2 Actorians beat me by force of numbers. They coveted victory because the biggest prizes were waiting. They were doubles. One took the reins and went bowling along. One talked to him with the whip. Ah, yes, once. That's what I was. Now it's the turn of younger men. Let them tackle such tasks. Old age is my master now, worse luck. But then I was high among the heroes. Now go ahead, there's your comrade to honour with games like the others. This gift I accept with grateful thanks, and it does my heart good that you remember me, your affectionate friend, and you do not forget the honour which is my due among our people. May the gods reward you according to your desire. Pelides listened to all the praises of the grand old man, and returned through the throng of spectators to his place. Next he displayed the prizes for boxing. A hard battle, that is, and the prize was a much-enduring mule, a 6-year-old yet unbroken, the hardest age to break. The prize for the loser was a 2-handled goblet. Achilles rose in his place and said, "Prince Atrides and gentlemen all, we invite the 2 best men to put up their hands and box for these prizes. He whom Apollo shall grant endurance before the face of the whole nation shall lead away to his quarters this much-enduring mule, and the loser shall carry off this 2-handled bowl." At once a fine big man came forward, Epeus, Panopeus' son, a good boxer. He laid a hand on the mule and said, "This way for anyone who wants the bowl. For the mule, no one else shall have it, for no one will beat me in the ring. There I claim to be the best man. I lack something in the battlefield, and is not that bad enough. A fellow can't be number 1 in every kind of work that's done." That's quite true. I tell you plainly, and I will make good my words, let him come on. I'll tear his flesh and smash his bones to a pulp. He had better bring his friends and relations in a body to carry him out when I've done with him. A dead silence followed these words. At last, one man, Euryalus, rose alone, a splendid fellow. He was the son of my lord Longman Standfast's son, who came to Thebes for the funeral of Oedipus after he took his deadly dump, and there beat all the Cadmeans. Tydides got him ready. He put on his belt, gave him the gloves of good oxhide straps, cheered him up, and wished him luck. The two men stepped forward, girt, into the ring, and put up their hands. Then they fell to it with stout fisticuffs, lead and parry. You might hear their teeth gnashing, and the sweat poured from their bodies. Euryalus watched warily for an opening, but at last Epeius landed him one on the jaw, and he did not stand long after that. He was knocked clean off his feet and lifted into the air, curving like a great fish that leaps out of the shallows, off the seaweed and through the ripples when Boreas blows, and into the dark waves again. So he came down, but his generous adversary helped him up, and his friends were ready to lead him away, dragging his legs and spitting blood and drooping his head to one side. So they led him away, dazed and fainting, and came back for the two-handled pole. Without delay, Pelides displayed the third set of prizes for the wrestling, and a hard bout that is. He showed the prizes all round. For the winner, a large tripod to stand on the fire, which the spectators valued at 12 oxen. For the loser, he brought out a woman, well skilled in women's work, valued at 4 oxen. Then he stood up and said, "Rise, any who wish to compete for this prize." Up rose that large man, Telamonian Eos. Up rose Odysseus, the man who was never at a loss, who knew all the tricks of the game. They girt them and stood forth into the ring, and their strong arms took hold of one another with a close grip. Their bodies looked like a pair of baulks which a builder leans together to hold up a high roof. Their backs creaked as the hard hands pulled steadily. Drops of sweat came out. Blood-red weals began to show on ribs and shoulders. Hard was their struggle for that fine tripod. But Odysseus could not bring his man down, nor could Eos, for Odysseus was too strong. As the spectators began to be bored by this, the large man, Eos, said to his adversary, "Prince Laertiades, Odysseus, never failing, either lift me or I will lift you, and as to the rest, Zeus will provide." As he spoke, he lifted, but Odysseus knew the trick. He knocked him behind the knee so that his leg gave way and threw him backwards. Odysseus fell on his chest to the admiration of all. Then Odysseus took his turn and tried to lift Eos, but he could not do it, only moved him a little from the ground. So he hooked his knee round and both fell together in the dirt. Then they would have tried for the third throw, but Achilles rose and stopped them. "That is enough," said he. "Don't tire yourselves out. I declare both men winners. Receive equal prizes, and let us go on to the next event." They were quite willing, wiped off the dust, and put on their tunics. Achilles now brought out prizes for the foot race. There was a silver mixing bowl, finely wrought, holding 6 measures. It was the most beautiful bowl in the world, for it was the work of Sidonian artists, and Phoenician merchants had brought it over the sea to the harbor of Lemnos, and given it to Thoas as a gift. His grandson Euneas, Iasonides, gave it to Patroclus as the prize for Lycaon. This bowl Achilles offered as first prize. For the second, a great fat ox, and for the last, a half nugget of gold. Then he got up and said, "Rise, any who wish to run for this prize." Eos the runner rose, Odysseus rose, then Nestor's son Antilochus, for he was the best runner among the young men. They stood in a row, and Achilles pointed out the goal. The pace was forced from the start, but before long Eos was leading, with Odysseus close behind him, close as the weaver holds the crossbeam to her breast while she pulls the spool across the warp. Odysseus trod in his footsteps before the dust had time to settle, and the breath of Odysseus beat on his head as he ran. The spectators cheered his efforts, but he was doing his very best already. When they came to the last bit of the course, Odysseus offered a silent prayer to Athena. "Hear me, my goddess, give thy good help to my feet." Pallas Athena heard and made his limbs light the feet and hands on him. And when they were just on the point to pounce on the prize, Athena tripped Eos and made him slip, where the place was covered with offal from the beasts which Achilles had butchered in honor of Patroclus. And down he went, got mouth and nostrils full of the stuff. So Odysseus came in first and lifted the mixing pole. And then Eos took hold of the ox. As he stood holding the animal's horn and spitting out the dirt, he said, "Damn it, that goddess tripped me up. She's always by his side like a mother and helps him."
All burst into a roar of laughter. Antilochus carried off the last prize, smiling, and he said to the people, "You know it quite well, my friends, but I will repeat it. The saying now is true again. The immortals honor older men.
Aeus is a little older than I am, but this Odysseus is one of the ancient generation. A green old age is his, as they say. Yet it would be a hard job for any of us to beat him in running, except only Achilles."
So he ended with a compliment to Achilles, and Achilles responded,
"Thanks, Antilochus. Your kind words shall not be said in vain. I will add half a nugget of gold to your prize."
He placed it in his hands as he spoke, and Antilochus received it with satisfaction.
Now Achilles brought out the armor of Sarpedon, which Patroclus had taken in the field, the long spear and the shield and helmet, and said, "We invite the two best men to contend for these. Let them arm themselves and take their blades and try one another before us. Whichever shall first pierce through the armor to what is within and touch the flesh and draw blood, to him I will give this fine Thracian sword silver-bossed, which I took from Asteropaeus. But the armor both shall hold together, and we will make a good feast to entertain them."
At this invitation uprose Telamonian Aeus, uprose Diomedes Tydides, and both donned their armor in the rear. Then they came forward to confront each other, glaring terribly to the admiration of all. They drew close. Thrice they charged, thrice they attacked. Then Aeus pierced the buckler, but he did not reach the flesh, for the corselet held the blow.
But Tydides reached over the great shield and touched the neck with his blade again and again. Then the people were afraid for Aeus. They called them to stop and share the prize. But Achilles gave Diomedes the sword with sheath and sling. Again Achilles brought out a lump of rough-cast iron, which that mighty man Aeetion used to hurl. When he killed Aeetion, he brought it away with the rest of the spoils. He rose now and said, "Rise, you who wish to contend for this prize. Any man will have enough here to use for 5 revolving years, even if his fat fields are far away. No shepherd or ploughman will need to visit the city for iron. There will be plenty at home." At this challenge uprose that redoubtable warrior Polypoetes, uprose Leontius the strong man, uprose Aeus Telamoniades and Prince Epeus. They stood in a row, and Epeus took up the weight, circled it round his head, and put it, and the people roared with laughter. Next to put the weight was Leontius, that veritable sprig of Ares. Third, Telamonian Aeus lifted it and hurled it. The cast from that strong man went beyond the others. But when Polypoetes raised the lump, he threw it as far beyond all the others as a herdsman sends his cudgel flying over the herds of cattle. There was a loud cheer, and his companions got up and carried away the prize to their camp. Next, for the archers, Achilles brought forward blue steel, 10 axes and 10 half-axes. Away on the sand he set up a ship's mast, with a rock dove tied to the top by a string round its leg. He told them to shoot at this. "Whoever hits the dove shall have all the axes to take home. Whoever misses the dove but hits the string shall have the half-axes." Then uprose Prince Teucros, and uprose Meriones, that excellent servant of Idomeneus. They shook their lance in a helmet, and Teucros won first shot. He let fly at once a strong shot, but he forgot to vow that he would make due sacrifice of firstling lambs to the Lord. So he missed the dove, since Apollo grudged that to him. He cut through the string close to the bird's foot. Away flew the bird into the sky, and the string fell to the ground amid the cheers of the people. But Meriones instantly snatched the bow from his hand. His arrow had been ready in hand while Teucros aimed. He vowed quickly that he would make due sacrifice of firstling lambs to Apollo shoot afar. High in the clouds he could see the dove. There he shot her under the wing as she circled round. The arrow went right through and fell down before the feet of Meriones and stuck in the ground. But the dove settled on the pole, head hanging and wings drooping. Then the life left her, and she fell away from the pole, to the amazement of all who saw it. Meriones took away the 10 axes, and Teucros had the half-axes. Again Pelides brought out a long spear, and a brand-new cauldron ornamented with flowers worth 1 ox, and the spear-throwers came forward. Up rose my lord King Agamemnon, up rose Meriones, the excellent servant of Idomeneus, but Achilles had something to say. "My lord king, we know how high you are exalted above all, and how you are the best in strength and in casting of spears. Very well, pray accept this prize and take it with you. But let us offer the spear to Meriones, if you approve. At least that is what I should like." My lord King Agamemnon was content. He gave the spear to Meriones and gave the prize into the hands of Talthybius, his herald. Book 24. How Priam and Achilles Met, and the Funeral of Hector. The assembly was dismissed, and the people dispersed to their own ships. Their thoughts were on food and quiet sleep. But Achilles wept, remembering his well-loved friend, and all-conquering sleep did not lay hold upon him. He turned this way and that way, thinking what manhood and fine temper he had lost with Patroclus, how many tasks he had wound up with him, how many hardships they had suffered together, wars with men and cruel seas they had cloven. As he remembered these things, he shed hot tears, now tossing on his side, now on his back, now prone. Again he would rise up and roam, distracted, along the seashore. Never did he fail to see the dawn appear over sea and shore. And then he would harness the horses and fasten Hector to drag behind the car. 3 times round the barrow of dead Menetides he would trail him, then return to rest in the hut, leaving him stretched prone in the dust. But Apollo kept the skin free from defilement. Pitying the poor fellow, though dead, he wrapped him all about with his golden cape that the dragging might never tear him. Thus Achilles maltreated Hector in his rage. But the blessed gods were offended at this pitiable sight, and wished to send Hermes Argifontes to steal him away. Most of the gods approved this, but not Hera, nor Poseidon, nor the bright-eyed maiden. They continued as they had been when first they came to hate sacred Troy and Priam and his people for the blind delusion of Alexandros. He had affronted those goddesses when they came to his farmyard, and he preferred the one who granted his shameful lust. But when the 12th dawn came, Phoebus Apollo said at last, "You are hard, my gods, you are torturers. Has not Hector in times past burnt you thigh pieces of bulls and goats without blemish? Yet you can't bear to save his dead body for his wife to see, and his mother and his son, and Priam, his father, and his people, to let them burn him in the fire and perform the rites of burial. But that abominable Achilles, he is the man you want to help, gods, the man who has no sense of decency, no mercy in his mind, savage as a lion, which is the slave of his strength and furious temper, and hunts the sheep for dinner. Like him, Achilles has lost all pity. He has in him none of that shame which does great good to men as well as harm. A man may have lost some dear one, I suppose, a brother or even a son, but he weeps and laments, and there is an end of it, for the fates have given mankind a patient soul. But this man, after he has taken the life of noble Hector, ties him behind his car and drags him round his comrade's tomb. I declare that is not right or decent. We may well be shocked at him, though he is a brave man. Even the senseless clay he insults in his fury." This made Hera angry, and she retorted, "That might be all very well, Silverbow, if you are going to put Achilles and Hector in the same rank. Hector's a mortal, and sucked a woman's pap. But Achilles had a goddess for his mother. I brought her up myself from a little one, and gave her away as a wife to a man, to Peleus, who was in high favour with the immortals. You were all at the wedding, gods, and you too, there you sat with your harp, but you prefer low company, and no one can ever trust you." Here Zeus broke in, "My dear Hera, don't go and get spiky with the gods. They shan't be in the same rank at all, but Hector really was a prime favourite with the gods, more than any man in Troy. Oh, at least I thought so, for he never failed in his friendly offerings. My altar was never without a good feast, or libations and spicy savours, our special prerogative. But let stealing alone. Can't be done. We can't steal away Hector so that Achilles won't see, for there is his mother on guard night and day. No, no, let one of you call Thetis before me, and I will give her some good advice. Achilles must accept ransom from Priam, and let him have Hector. This was no sooner said than Stormfoot Iris was off with her message. Midway between Samothrace and rocky Imbros, down she plunged into the dark sea with a splash, plunged into the deep like a leaden plummet on a hornbait which carries death to the greedy fishes. She found Thetis in a vaulted cave, and the other nymphs of the sea sitting round her. She was lamenting her perfect son, doomed to perish in Troy so far from his native land. Iris stood before her and said, "Rise up, Thetis. Zeus all-wise summons you before him." Silverfoot Thetis answered, "Why does the great god summon me? I'm ashamed to show myself among the immortals when my heart is so full of infinite sorrow. However, I will go. No word that he speaks will be spoken in vain." She took a dark veil, as black as any garment could be, and followed Iris, and the water gave way before them. They stepped out on the beach and shot up to heaven. There they found Cronides all-seeing, and the deathless gods were seated about him in full assembly. Athena was next to Father Zeus, but she gave up her seat to Thetis. Hera placed a golden cup in her hands with friendly words of welcome, and Thetis drank and gave back the cup. Then the father of gods and men spoke. "So you have come to Olympus, goddess Thetis. Although you are sad and your heart is full of sorrow that will not be comforted, I know that myself. But still, I sent for you, and I will tell you why. For 9 days there has been quarrelling in our family about Hector's body and Achilles. They want Argifontes to steal the body away. But I want to keep your respect and affection in time to come, and so I propose to raise your son even higher in men's esteem, and this is how it will be done. Go straight to the camp. Tell your son the gods are angry with him, and I most of all have been moved to wrath, because in his mad passion he keeps Hector and has not let him go. I hope he will fear me and let him go. I will send Iris myself to King Priam and bid him to visit the Achaean camp and ransom his son. He shall bring treasure enough to warm the heart of Achilles." Thetis lost no time. She made haste to her son's hut and found him there, sobbing and groaning. His companions were busy preparing their meal. They had just killed a shaggy ram which lay in the hut. His mother sat near him and stroked his head, saying, "My child, how long will you eat your heart out with sorrow and lamentation? Never a thought for bread or bed? Even a woman to love you is some comfort, and I shall not have you long, but death and cruel fate are at hand. Now listen to me quickly. I bear a message from Zeus to you. He says the gods are angry with you, and he, most of all, has been moved to wrath, because in your mad passion you keep Hector and won't let him go. Make haste now. Take ransom and let him go."
Achilles answered, "Let someone come here with a ransom and take the body, if the Olympian himself commands and really means it." Long the mother and the son talked together without concealment, heart to heart. And at the same time Cronides was sending Iris to Ilios.
"Off you go, Iris, my quick one. Leave Olympus behind you and hasten to Troy. Announce to King Priam that he is to go to the Achaean camp and carry treasure enough to warm the heart of Achilles. He must be alone. Not another man of the Trojans must go with him. But a herald may attend him, some old man, to drive the mules and the wagon, and also to bring back the body of him that Achilles slew. Do not let him fear death or be anxious at all. I will provide for that by sending Argifontes as his escort, to lead him as far as Achilles. And when he shall lead him into the hut, neither Achilles nor anyone else shall kill him. For Achilles is not stupid or thoughtless or impious. He will be most scrupulous to spare a suppliant man.
Away went Stormfoot Iris on her errand. She came to Priam's, and there she found groaning and lamentation. The sons were sitting in the courtyard about their father, soaking their garments in tears.
The old man was in their midst, wrapped closely in his mantle, with muck smeared all over head and neck, which he had clawed up in handfuls as he grovelled on the ground.
In the house his daughters and his good daughters were wailing, as they called to mind all those brave men who lay dead by their enemies' hands. The messenger drew near to Priam. He fell into a fit of trembling, and she spoke softly to him. "Fear nothing, Priamos Dardanides. Be not anxious at all. I come here with no evil tidings, but with good in my heart for you. I am a messenger from Zeus, who far away cares for you much and pities you. The Olympian bids you ransom, Prince Hector. You are to carry treasure to Achilles, enough to warm his heart. You must be alone. No other Trojan must go with you, but a herald may attend you, some old man, to drive the mules and wagon, and to bring back the body of him that Achilles slew. You are not to fear death, or to be anxious at all. Zeus will provide for that by sending Argifontes as your escort, and he shall lead you as far as Achilles. Even when he shall lead you into the hut, neither Achilles nor anyone else will kill you, for he will prevent them. Achilles is not stupid or thoughtless or impious, and he will be scrupulous to spare a suppliant man."
She gave her message, and she was gone. The old king gave orders at once to get ready a mule wagon and to put on the top carrier. Meanwhile he went into his treasure chamber, roofed with sweet-smelling cedar, in which he kept many precious things, and called to his wife Hecabe, "My dear, what a surprise! An Olympian messenger has come from Zeus, that I am to go into the Achaean camp and ransom our dear son. I am to carry treasure enough to warm the heart of Achilles. Now then, tell me, what do you think about it? As for me, I am terribly anxious to go and visit the Achaean ships and the Achaean camp." The woman shrieked and said, "Oh, misery! Where are your wits flown? Once you were famous for good sense throughout your kingdom and even in foreign lands. How can you wish to visit the Achaean ships alone, to meet the eyes of the man who has killed and stripped so many of your brave sons? Your heart must be made of steel. If he sets eyes on you, if he gets hold of you, that is a faithless man, a cannibal. He'll never have pity, he'll never have mercy. No, no, let us stay in our own house and lament him far away. As for him, that is how inflexible fate spun her thread for him when I brought him forth from my womb, to be devoured by carrion dogs far from his father and mother in the house of a violent man. Oh, I could fix my teeth in his liver and devour it. That would be some revenge for my son. The man he slew was not playing the coward's part. He was standing to shield Trojan men and Trojan women, and thought neither of shelter nor of flight." The old king answered, "Don't hold me back when I want to go. Don't be a bad omen for me yourself. You will never persuade me. If someone else had bidden me go, a mere mortal man, such as a priest or seer or diviner, we might think it falsehood and keep clear of the whole thing. But now I heard a god's voice with my own ears. I saw with my own eyes. Go I will, and his word shall not be in vain. If it is my portion to die in the Achaean camp, I am willing. Let the man kill me on the spot when once I have held my son in my arms and lamented him as I have so long to do." Then he opened the store chests and took out 12 resplendent robes and 12 singlet cloaks, as many rugs and white sheets, as many tunics. He took out gold and weighed 10 nuggets, next 2 shining tripods and 4 cauldrons, and a magnificent goblet which a Thracian embassy had presented, a great treasure. Not even this did he grudge, for he greatly desired to ransom his son.
Lastly, he drove away all the people from the corridor with a good rating.
"Get out, for shame! Don't make yourselves a nuisance here. Have you no mourning at home, that you come here to vex me?
What good have you gained that Zeus Cronides has sent trouble upon me, and I have lost the best of my sons?
You shall find that out yourselves when you will be easier than ever to kill, now that man is dead. Oh, may I go down to the gates of death before I see the city wasted and sacked before my eyes."
He hurried among them, driving them out with his staff, and then he cried out to his sons. There were 9 of them in the place, Helenus and Paris and Agathon, Pammon and Antiphonus and Polites, Deiphobus and Hippothous and Dios.
"Make haste there, you worthless sons. I'm ashamed of you, hangdogs. I wish you had all been killed instead of Hector.
How unhappy I am. I had the best sons in the broad land of Troy, and I declare not one is left. Mestor, too good for this world, and Troilus, the famous chariot fighter, and Hector, who was like one come down from heaven to live on earth. He seemed to be no son of mortal man, as if a god must have been his father. These are all killed in battle, and only rubbish is left, cheats and tumblers, heroes of the dancing floor, grand men to raid their neighbors' cattle and sheep. Get ready a wagon, will you, and be quick about it, and put in all this stuff. We have a journey to make." They were all startled by their father's outburst and got to work. So they brought out a fine new mule wagon with its wheels and fastened on the top carrier. They took down from the peg a boxwood yoke fitted with knob and rings for the reins. Then they brought out the yoke with its yoke band, 9 cubits long, and fitted it on the pole at the curving end and the ring over the pin. They tied it over the knob with 3 turns to left and right, and carried the rope back to the car post, tucking the tongue under the rope. This done, they brought out from the treasury all the precious things for Hector's ransom and packed them on the wagon. They put to a couple of strong-footed mules broken to harness, which had been a gift of the missions to Priam. For Priam, they yoked a pair of horses which he had bred himself and fed at the manger. As Priam and the herald were about these preparations and considering how they should behave, Hecuba, in deep dejection, came near. She held a golden goblet of wine in her right hand that they might pour a libation before they went, and standing before the car, she said, "Take this, and pour to Zeus the Father, and pray for a safe return from our enemies, since your mind is set upon going, although I wished it not. Now pray to Cronion Thundercloud upon Mount Ida, whose eye can see all the Trojan land, and ask for a bird on the right hand, that swift messenger whom he loves more than all the birds, the strongest bird of all, that you may see him with your eyes, and have him to trust in this journey to the Danian camp. If Zeus all-seeing shall refuse to send his messenger, I at least would bid you not to go to the place, however you may desire it."
King Priam answered, "My wife, I will not refuse what you ask, for it is well to lift up our hands to Zeus and pray him to have mercy upon us." The old king called to a waiting woman for pure water. She brought jug and bowl and poured the water over his hands. He then took the cup from his wife and, standing in the courtyard, poured the wine upon the ground, raising his eyes to heaven as he uttered this prayer. "O Zeus, our father, most mighty and most glorious, enthroned upon Mount Ida, grant that Achilles may show me kindness and pity, and send me a bird, that swift messenger, whom thou lovest more than all the birds, the strongest bird of all. Show him on my right hand, that I may see him with my eyes, and have him to trust in this journey to the Danian camp." So he prayed, and Zeus, all-wise, heard him. At once he sent an eagle, most unfailing omen among birds that fly, the dark one, the hunter, the one that men also call Dapple. The stretch of his outspread wings was as wide as the bolted door of a rich man's lofty treasure-house. They saw him on the right sailing over the city. All that saw him were glad, and their hearts were warmed within them.
Now the old king made haste to mount his car and drove out of the front gateway from the echoing gallery. The mules went in front, drawing their four-wheeled wagon, with Idaeus driving, and the horses followed, ridden by the old king. As they passed quickly through the city, all his kinsfolk followed, weeping and wailing as if he were going to his death. But as soon as they had come down from the city upon the plain, these all went back, sons and good sons together. Zeus did not fail to see the two men when they appeared upon the plain. He pitied the old king, and said to Hermes, his son, "Hermes, you always like to make friends with a man and have a talk with anyone you fancy. Off with you, then, and lead Priam to the Achaean camp. Take care that no one sees or takes any notice until you get to Pelion." Argifontes was willing enough. He put on those fine boots, golden, incorruptible, which carry him over moist or dry to the ends of the earth as quick as the wind, and he took the rod that bewitches the eyes of men to sleep, or wakes the sleeping. Holding this, Argifontes flew until he reached the Hellespont and the land of Troy. There he took the shape of a young prince, with the first down upon his lip, the time when youth is most charming. The others had just passed beyond the great barrow of Ilos, and they halted by the river to give the animals a drink, for darkness had come by this time. The herald looked out and noticed Hermes not far off, and he said to his master, "Where, man, Dardanides, a wary mind is now what we want. I spy a man, and I surmise he'll soon tear us to pieces. Come, let us take the horse-car and be off, unless you would have us clasp his knees and beg for mercy." The old man was all confusion and frightened to death. He felt goose-flesh all over his body and stood dazed. But Hermes Luckbringer came up of himself and said, taking him by the hand, "Whither away, father, with horses and mules in the dead of night, when mortal men are all asleep but you? Have you no fear of the Achaeans, breathing fury, your enemies and bad men to meet? If one of them saw you driving all these commodities through the black night, what would you do then? You are not young yourself, and this, your follower, is old for defense if someone wants to pick a quarrel. But I will do you no harm. Indeed, I would protect you. You remind me of my own father." Then the old king replied, "Things are very much as you say, dear boy, but there is still some god, even for me, who stretched a hand over me when he sent a wayfarer like you to meet me. A good man to meet, if I may judge from your handsome looks and shape, and no unmannerly savage. You must come of a good family." Argifontes answered, "Quite right, sir, that is true enough. But tell me, please, if I may ask you, are you exporting all these precious goods to a foreign land just to put them in safety? Or are you all deserting sacred Troy in fear? For the great man has perished, the noblest of them all. Your son, he never hung back from the battlefield." The old king said, "And who are you, noble sir? What is your family? How truly you have told me the passing of my ill-fated son." Argifontes replied, "You are trying me, sir, when you ask about noble Hector. Often I have seen him with my own eyes in the field of glory. Then also when he drove the Achaeans upon their ships and slew, making havoc with his blade. We had to stand and admire, for Achilles would not let us fight because of his rancor against Agamemnon. I am a servant of his, and we came over in the same ship. I am one of the Myrmidons. My father is called Polyctor. He is a rich man and old, just like yourself here. He has six other sons. I was the seventh. We cast lots who should join up, and the lot fell on me. I have just come away from the ships to the plain, for tomorrow the Achaeans will open battle against the city. They hate sitting idle, and the princes cannot hold them back." Then old King Priam said, "If you are really a servant of Achilles Pelides, pray tell me the whole truth. Is my son still there by the ships? Or has Achilles cut him to pieces and thrown him to the dogs?" Argifontes answered, "Dear sir, no dogs and vultures have touched him yet. But there he lies beside the ship of Achilles as he was. 12 days he has been lying there, and his flesh is not decayed, nor do the worms eat him as they eat the dead on the battlefield. It is true, Achilles drags him callously round his comrade's barrow at dawn every day, but it does him no harm. You would open your eyes if you could come and see how he lies as fresh as dew, washed clean of blood and nowhere nasty. The wounds have all healed up, and there were many who pierced him. See how the gods care for your son, even in death, for he was very dear to them. This made the old man happy, and he replied, "My dear boy, it is good indeed to give the immortals their proper due. For my dead son, as truly as he lived, never forgot the gods who dwell in Olympus. Therefore they have remembered him, although death is now his portion. But pray do accept from me this pretty cup, and protect me, and guide me with God's help, that I may find my way to the hut of Pelides." Argiafontes said, "You are trying me, sir. You are old, and I am young, but I cannot consent when you ask me to accept a gift behind the back of Achilles. I fear him, and I should be heartily ashamed to defraud him, or something bad might happen to me. But you shall be my charge. I would guide you carefully as far as Argos, by land or by sea, and no one should despise your guide or attack you." With this, Luckbringer jumped into the car and took the whip and reins into his hands and filled horses and mules with spirit. So they went on until they reached the wall and moat. The watchmen were then busy about their supper, but Argiafontes sent them all to sleep, and in a moment ran back the bars and opened the gates and brought in Priam and the wagon with its precious cargo. They came at last to the hut of Achilles. It was a tall building, which the men had made for their prince, walls of fir planks, thatched with a downy roofing of reeds which they had gathered from the meadows. In front was a wide courtyard surrounded by thick-set stakes. The door was held by one firwood bar. It took 3 men to push home the bar, and 3 men to pull it open, but Achilles could push it home by himself. This time Hermes jumped down and opened the door for the old king, and brought in the precious gifts for Achilles. After that he said, "I must tell you, sir, that I am an immortal god, Hermes, and my father sent me to be your guide. But I must go back now, and I must not show myself to Achilles. It would be a shocking thing if a mortal should entertain an immortal god for all to see. You go in and clasp his knees, and beseech him, in the name of his father and mother and his son, to touch his heart." So Hermes took his leave and went back to Olympus. But Priam dismounted and went towards the house, leaving Idaeus where he was to hold the horses and mules. He found Achilles alone. Only 2 were waiting upon him, Automaton and Alcimus, and he had just finished eating and drinking. The table was still beside him. Priam came in, but they did not see him. He came near Achilles and clasped his knees and kissed the terrible, murderous hands that had killed so many of his sons. Achilles looked with amazement at royal Priam, and the 2 men also were amazed and stared at each other as people stare when someone from a foreign land takes refuge in a rich man's house after he has killed a man in a fit of madness and has to flee the country. Then Priam made his prayer. "Remember your own father, most noble Prince Achilles, an old man like me near the end of his days. It may be that he is distressed by those who live round about him, and there is no one to defend him from peril and death. But he, indeed, so long as he hears that you still live, is glad at heart, and hopes every day that he will see his well-loved son return home from Troy. But I am all unhappy, since I had the best sons in the broad land of Troy, and I say not one of them has been left. 50 had I when the men of Achaea came, 19 born to me of one womb, the others of women in my household. All those many have fallen in battle, and my only one, who by himself was our safeguard, that one you killed the other day fighting for his country, Hector, For him I come now to your camp to redeem him from you. And I bring a rich ransom. O Achilles, fear God and pity me, remembering your own father. But I am even more to be pitied. I have endured to do what no other man in the world has ever done, to lift my hand to the lips of the man who slew my son. As he said it, he lifted his hand to the face of Achilles. And the heart of Achilles ached with anguish at the thought of his father. He took the old man's hand and pushed him gently away. So the two thought of their dead and wept, one for his Hector while he crouched before the feet of Achilles, and Achilles for his own father, and then for Patroclus. When his agony had passed and he could move again, he got up from his seat and raised the old man by the hand, pitying his white hairs and white beard, and spoke simply from heart to heart. "Ah, poor man, indeed your heart has borne many sorrows. How could you come to the Achaean camp alone? How could you bear to look on the man who killed all your noble sons, as I have done? Your heart must be made of steel. Come now, sit down upon a seat. We will let our sorrows lie deep in our hearts a while, for there is no profit in freezing lamentation. This is the way the gods have spun their threads for poor mortals. Our life is all sorrow, but they are untroubled themselves. Zeus has two jars of the gifts that he gives standing upon the floor beside him, one of good things and one of evil things. When the thunderer mixes and gives, a man meets with good sometimes and bad other times. When he gives all bad, he makes the man despised and rejected. Grinding misery drives him over the face of the earth, and he walks without honor from gods or from men. And so with Peleus the gods gave him glorious gifts from his birth, for he was preeminent in the world for wealth and riches. He was king over the Myrmidons. And although he was mortal, they made a goddess his wife. But God gave him evil, too, because he got no family of royal princes in his palace, but only one son, to die before his time. And now he is growing old, and I cannot care for him, for I am here in Troy, far from my country, troubling you and your children. You also, sir, once were happy, as we hear. Up sea, as far as Lesbos, the seat of Macar, upland to Phrygia, and along the boundless Hellespont, you were paramount in your riches and your sons. But ever since the lords of heaven brought this calamity upon you, there has been nothing but battle and manslaughter about your city. Endure it, and let not your heart be uncomforted, for you will have no profit by sorrowing for your son. You will never raise him from the dead. Before that, some other trouble will come upon you. The old king answered, "Tell me not yet to be seated, gracious prince, while Hector lies here uncared for. I pray you set him free quickly, that I may look upon him and accept the ransom that we bring, a great treasure. May you live to enjoy it and return to your own country, since you have spared me first." Achilles frowned and said, "Tease me no more, sir. I mean myself to set your Hector free. Zeus sent me a message by my mother, the daughter of the old man of the sea. And I understand quite well, sir, that some god brought you into our camp. For no mere man would dare to come among us, let him be ever so young and strong. He would not escape the guards, and he could not easily lever back the bolt of our doors. Then provoke my temper no more in my sorrow, or I may not spare even you, sir, although you are a suppliant. And that would be sin against the commands of Zeus." The old man was afraid and said no more. But Pelides leapt out like a lion, and the two attendants followed, Automedon and Alcimus, the men whom he trusted most after dead Patroclus. They unharnessed the horses and mules and led in the old king's crier to a seat. Then they unpacked Hector's ransom from the wagon, except two sheets and a tunic, which they left to wrap up the body for its journey home. Achilles called out women to wash and anoint the body, but first he moved it out of the way. He did not wish Priam to see his son, and perhaps burst into anger from the sorrow of his heart when he saw him, for then he feared that he might be provoked himself to kill him, and sin against the commands of Zeus. After the women had washed the body and anointed it with oil and put on the tunic and wrapped the sheet around, Achilles himself lifted him and laid him upon the bier, and his attendants carried him to the mule car. Then he cried aloud and called on the name of his lost friend. "Don't be cross with me, Patroclus, if you hear even in Hades that I have given back Hector to his father. Since the ransom he paid is not unworthy, you shall have your due share of this also." Then Achilles returned into his hut and sat down on the bench where he had been before, against the opposite wall, and spoke to Priam. "Your son, sir, has been set free now, as you asked, and he lies on his bier. At break of day you shall see him yourself on your journey. But just now let us think of supper. Even beautiful Niobe thought of something to eat after she had lost 12 children in her own house, 6 daughters and 6 sons in their prime. Apollo shot the boys with his silver bow, and Artemis Archeress the girls. They were angry because Niobe compared herself with Leto, said she had borne 12 and Leto only 2. So those only 2 killed them all. They lay 9 days in their blood, and there was no one to bury them, for Cronion had turned the people into pebbles. But after all, the heavenly ones buried them on the 10th day. So then she thought of something to eat when she was tired of shedding tears. Now she is somewhere among the rocks, on a lovely mountain in Sipylos, where the beds of the nymphs divine are said to be, the ones that danced about the river Achelous. There, stone though she is, she broods over the sorrows which the gods brought on her. Well then, venerable prince, let us too also think of something to eat. After that you may weep for your son again when you have brought him back to Ilios. Many tears he will cost you." Then Achilles got up and killed a white lamb. His comrades flayed it and prepared it, cut it up, spit it and broiled it, and laid the meat on the table. Automedon brought baskets of bread, and Achilles served the meat. When they had eaten and drunk all they wanted, Priamus Dardanides gazed at Achilles, admiring his fine looks and stature. Indeed, he seemed like some god come down from heaven. And Achilles gazed at Priamus Dardanides, admiring his noble face and speech. They looked at each other a long time. And then the old king said, "Put me to bed now quickly, my prince. Let us lie down and sleep quietly and rest, for my eyes have never closed under my eyelids since my son lost his life at your hands. All this time I have mourned and brooded over my endless sorrow, tossing about in the muck of my courtyard. Now I have tasted food, and I have let the wine run down my throat. Until now I touched nothing." Achilles gave orders at once to lay beds in the porch, and strew on them rugs of fine purple with blankets above and woolen robes to wear. The women, torch in hand, went to get ready 2 beds, and Achilles said a light word or two. "You must lie outside, my dear sir, for I may have a visit from one of the counselors from headquarters. They are forever coming and sitting here and counseling their councils as if it were a public meeting. If one of them should spy you here in the middle of the night, he would go at once and report it to His Majesty King Agamemnon, and there would be delay in releasing the dead. But tell me, please, if I may ask the question, how many days do you think of to perform the funeral solemnities? I will stay here and keep the people quiet for that time." The king answered, "If you are willing to let me do the funeral rites for Prince Hector, you will do that for which I shall be deeply grateful. You know how we are crowded into the city. It is a long way for us to get the wood from the mountains, and the people are very much afraid. We would mourn him 9 days in the house. On the 10th we would bury him and feast the people. On the 11th we would build a barrow, and on the 12th we will fight, if we must." Achilles said, "It shall be as you ask, venerable king.
I will hold back the battle for the time you say." Then he clasped the old man's right wrist, that he might fear nothing, and led him to the porch where he was to sleep with the herald. Achilles himself lay to rest in a corner of the hut, with lovely Briseis by his side. All were fast asleep throughout that night, both in heaven and on earth, except Hermes, who could not sleep for thinking how he should bring away King Priam out of the camp and keep the watchmen at the gate from seeing. He stood by the old man's bed and said to him, "Sir, you do not seem to care what happens sleeping like that in the midst of your enemies, because Achilles spared you. Now then, you have redeemed your son. You have paid a heavy ransom, but you alive will cost 3 times as much for your other sons to get you back if Agamemnon Atrides finds out or the Achaeans find out." This frightened the old man, and he woke up the herald. Hermes harnessed the horses and mules and drove quickly through the camp, and no one found out. But when they reached the ford of the Xanthos, Hermes left them and returned to Olympus. Then the saffron robe of dawn spread over all the earth, and they drove towards the city, mourning and lamenting, while the mules brought the dead. No man and no woman had seen them coming. Cassandra was the first. She had gone up into the citadel, and from there she caught sight of her father standing in his car, and the city crier, and the other lying on a bier in the mule wagon. She lifted her voice in wailing and cried for the whole town to hear, "Come, all you men and women of Troy, you shall see Hector. Come, if ever you were glad while he lived, to welcome his return from battle, for he was a great gladness to the city and all the nation." Then grief intolerable came upon every heart. Not a man, not a woman was left behind in the city. All crowded out of the gates and met the dead. First came his wife and his mother, tearing their hair. They ran to the wagon and threw their arms over his head, while the people stood mourning around. They would have stayed there all day, weeping and wailing, but the old king called out from his car, "Let the mules pass! When I have brought him into our house, you will have plenty of time to lament." So the people made way for the wagon to pass. When he had been brought home, they laid him out on a bier and posted beside him mourners to lead the dirge, who sang their lamentable dirge while the women wailed in chorus. Andromache laid her white arms about the head of her dead warrior and led the lament. "My husband, you have perished out of life, still young, and left me a widow in the house. The boy is only a baby, your son and my son, doomed father, doomed mother. And he, I think, will never grow up to manhood. Long before that, our city will be utterly laid waste, for you have perished. You, our watchman, you, our only savior, who kept safe our wives and little children. They will soon be carried off in ships, and I with them. And you, my child, you will go with me where degrading tasks will be found for you to do, drudging under a merciless master. Or some enemy will catch you by the arm and throw you over the wall to a painful death in revenge, perhaps, for some brother that Hector killed, or father, or son, maybe, since many a man bit the dust under the hands of Hector. Your father was not gentle in the field of battle. Therefore the people throughout the city lament for him. And you have brought woe and mourning unspeakable upon your parents, Hector. But for me most of all cruel sorrow shall be left, for you did not stretch out to me your dying hands from your deathbed. You said no precious word to me, which I might always remember night and day with tears." So Andromache spoke weeping, and the women wailed in chorus. Then Hecuba led the lament amid her sobs, "Hector, best beloved of all my children, dearest to my heart, living, the gods loved you well. Therefore they have cared for you, even when death is your lot. Other sons of mine Achilles took, and he would sell them over the barren sea, one to Samos, one to Imbros, or to steaming Lemnos. But you, when he had torn out your soul with his sharp blade, he dragged you again and again round the barrow of his comrade whom you slew. But that did not bring him back from the grave.
And now you lie in my house, fresh as the morning dew, like one that Apollo Silverbow has visited and slain with his gentle shafts. So Hecuba spoke weeping, and the women wailed long in chorus. Helen came third and led the lament. Hector, best beloved of all my good brothers and dearest to my heart. Indeed, my husband is Prince Alexandros, who brought me to Troy. But would that I had died first. 20 years have passed since I left my country and came here, but I never heard from you one unkind or one slighting word. If anyone else reproached me, a sister or brother of yours, or a brother's wife, or your mother, for your father was always kind, as if he were mine, you would reprove them, you would check them with your gentle spirit and gentle words. Therefore I weep for you, and with you for my unhappy self, for there is no one else in the length and breadth of Troy who is kind or friendly. They all shudder at me. So she spoke weeping, and the people wailed long and loud. Then old King Priam said, Now, Trojans, fetch wood into the city, and have no fear of any ambush of our enemies, for Achilles, in parting from me, promised that he would do us no harm until the 12th day shall dawn. Then they put oxen and mules to their wagons and assembled before the city. 9 days they gathered infinite quantities of wood. When the 10th day dawned, they carried out brave Hector, weeping, and laid the body on the pile and set it on fire. When, on the next day, dawn showed her rosy fingers through the mists, the people gathered round about the pyre of Hector. First they quenched the flame with wine wherever the fire had burnt. Then his brothers and his comrades gathered his white bones with hot tears rolling down their cheeks. They placed the bones in a golden casket and wrapped it in soft purple cloth. This they laid in a hollow space, and built it over with large stones. Quickly they piled a barrow, with men on the lookout, all round, in case the Achaeans should attack before their time. This work done, they returned to the city, and the whole assemblage had a famous feast in the palace of Priam, their king. That was the funeral of Hector.
This concludes the reading of The Iliad by Homer, translated by W.H.D. Rouse. This book was read by Anthony Heald. This unabridged recording was produced in 2008 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you. Blackstone Audio presents The Odyssey, the story of Odysseus by Homer. Translated by W.H.D. Rouse. Book 1. What went on in the house of Odysseus? This is the story of a man, one who was never at a loss. He had traveled far in the world after the sack of Troy, the virgin fortress. He saw many cities of men and learnt their mind. He endured many troubles and hardships in the struggle to save his own life and to bring back his men safe to their homes. He did his best, but he could not save his companions, for they perished by their own madness, because they killed and ate the cattle of Hyperion, the sun god, and the god took care that they should never see home again. At the time when I begin, all the others who had not been killed in the war were at home, safe from the perils of battle and sea.
But he was alone, longing to get home to his wife. He was kept prisoner by a witch, Calypso, a radiant creature, and herself one of the great family of gods, who wanted him to stay in her cave and be her husband. Well, then, the seasons went rolling by, and when the year came, in which, by the thread that fate spins for every man, he was to return home to Ithaca, he had not yet got free of his troubles and come back to his own people. The gods were all sorry for him, except Poseidon, god of the sea, who bore a lasting grudge against him all the time until he returned. But it happened that Poseidon went for a visit a long way off to the Ethiopians, who live at the ends of the earth, some near the sunrise, some near the sunset. There he expected a fine sacrifice of bulls and goats, and there he was, feasting and enjoying himself mightily. But the other gods were all gathered in the palace of Olympian Zeus. Then the father of gods and men made them a speech, for his heart was angry against a man, Aegisthus, and Agamemnon's son Orestes, as you know, had just killed the man. So he spoke to the company as follows. Upon my word, just see how mortal men always put the blame on us gods. We are the source of evil, so they say, when they have only their own madness to thank if their miseries are worse than they ought to be. Look here now, Aegisthus has done what he ought not to have done, took Agamemnon's wedded wife for himself, killed Agamemnon when he came home, though he knew quite well it would be his own ruin. We gave him fair warning, sent our special messenger, Hermes, and told him not to kill the man, nor to make love to his wife. Their son, Orestes, would punish him when he grew up and wanted his own dominions. Hermes told him plainly. But he could do nothing with Aegisthus, although it was for his own good. Now he has paid the debt in one lump sum. Then up spoke Athena, with her bright eyes glinting. Cronides, our father, king of kings and lord of lords, I have nothing to say for Aegisthus. He richly deserved his ruin. So perish anyone else who does a thing like that. But what about that clever Odysseus? I'm anxious about him, poor fellow, kept from his friends all this while, in trouble and sorrow, in that island covered with trees and nothing but the waves all round it, in the very middle of the sea. It is the home of one of ourselves, the daughter of Atlas. You remember that creature of mischief who knows all the depths of the sea? You know, he holds up the pillars which keep earth and heaven apart. It is his daughter who keeps the wretched man a prisoner. She's always coaxing him with soft, deceitful words to forget Ithaca. But Odysseus would be happy to see as much as the smoke leaping up from his native land, and then to die. And you cannot spare him a thought, Olympian. Don't you owe him something for all those sacrifices which he used to offer in their camp on the plain of Troy? Why have you such an odd grudge against him, Zeus? Then Zeus, cloud-gatherer, answered, "My child, what a word to let out between your teeth. How could I forget that fine fellow Odysseus, after all? He is almost one of us, wise beyond mortal men, ready beyond all to offer sacrifice to the lords of the broad heavens. But Poseidon Earthholder bears him unrelenting hatred because of the Cyclops whose eye he put out. I mean Polyphemus, who has our blood in his veins, the most powerful of all the Cyclopians. Thoosa was his mother, the daughter of Phorcys, prince of the barren brine. Poseidon possessed her in a hollow cave. Ever since then, Poseidon has kept the man wandering about, although he does not kill him outright. Come now, let us all try to think how we can persuade Poseidon to abate his anger and let him go home to his native land. Surely he would not be able to stand out against all the immortals and keep up a quarrel all by himself. Then Athena said, Cronides, our father, king of kings and lord of lords, if all the gods now agree that Odysseus shall return to his home, then let us dispatch our messenger Hermes Agiphontes to the island of Ogygia, and let him announce forthwith to the nymph our unchangeable will that Odysseus, after all he has patiently endured, shall return home. And I will myself go to Ithaca to put heart into his son and make him do something. He shall call the people to a meeting, and speak his mind to all the would-be bridegrooms who have been butchering his sheep and his cattle in heaps. And I will send him to Sparta,
and to Sandy Pylos, to inquire about his beloved father, if he can hear that he is on his way home. That will be some credit to him in the world. So saying, she fastened under her feet those fine shoes, imperishable shoes of gold, which used to carry her over moist and dry to the ends of the earth, quick as the blowing of the breeze. Down she went shooting from the peaks of Olympus, and stood in the town of Ithaca, against the outer gates of Odysseus, upon the threshold of the courtyard. In her hand she held a spear of bronze, and she took the form of a family friend, Mentes, chief man of the Taphians. So there she found those high and mighty gallants. Just then they were amusing themselves with a game of draughts in front of the door, sitting on the skins of the cattle which they had killed themselves, and their orderlies and servants were all busy, some mixing wine and water in the great bowls, some wiping up the tables with oozing sponges and laying the dishes, some serving the meat, and there was plenty of it. Telemachus saw the visitor long before the others. He was a fine-looking boy, and he sat there among the intruders in deep distress, with his heart full of his noble father. He wondered if his father would suddenly appear and make a clean sweep of them all, and take his own honorable place again and manage his property. These were his thoughts as he sat among them, and saw someone at the door. He went straight to the porch, indignant to think that a visitor should be left standing at the door. He took the visitor's right hand, and relieved him of the spear, and spoke to him in words that wing like arrows to the mark. "Good day to you, sir. You will be welcome in our house. Refresh yourself, and after you have eaten and drunk, you shall say what you have come for." So saying, he led the stranger in. Then, as soon as they were within the lofty hall, he carried the spear to a tall pillar, and set it in a polished spear-stand, in which other spears were standing, the spears of Odysseus, that patient man, a whole lot of them. Then he led his visitor to a seat and bade him be seated. He threw a rug over it, a beautiful rug, an artist's work, and there was a footstool ready at his feet. Beside him he placed an armchair of carven work, apart from the rest of the company, for he did not wish the visitor to be disgusted by the noise, and to lose all relish for his food as he found himself amongst a rabble of bullies. He wanted also to ask about his lost father. A servant brought the hand wash for the visitor and poured it over his hands from a jug all made of fine gold into a silver basin. He drew up to the seat a polished table. A comely maid brought in the victuals and put them on the table, all sorts of things. She did not spare her store. The carver added plates of all sorts of meat and set beside them cups of gold. An orderly kept their cups filled with wine. In came the gallants, full of pride. They flung themselves down at once into chairs or settles, one after another, and the orderlies poured water over their hands, while the women piled up heaps of rolls in the baskets, and the boys filled the mixing bowls with drink to the brim. Then they put out their hands to take the good things that lay ready. At last, when they had eaten and drunk till they wanted no more, their fancies turned to other things, singing and dancing, for these are the graces of a feast. An orderly brought a beautiful harp and put it in the hands of Phemius, who used to sing for them because he could not help it. So he struck up a prelude for his song. Then Telemachus spoke to Mentes, who was really Athena, and he brought his head close that the others might not hear. "Kind sir, will you think me rude if I say something to you? You see what these fellows care about, music and song. Easy enough when someone else pays for the food they eat. A man whose white bones are lying on the ground and rotting in the rain, no doubt, or rolling about in the salt sea. That man! If they only caught sight of him here in Ithaca once more, they would gladly give a fortune of gold for a light pair of heels. But he is dead and gone in this miserable way, and there is no comfort for us, even if there are people in the world who say he will come back. No, the day of his return will never dawn. Well now, please, tell me this. I want to know all about you. Who are you? Where do you come from? Where is your country? What is your family? What ship carried you here? I don't suppose you walked all the way.
How was it those sailors brought you to Ithaca? Who did they say they were? And another thing I want you to tell me, is it your first visit, or are you a friend of our family? For a great many other men used to come to our place, since that man also was a traveler in the world. Athena answered him with her bright eyes glinting.
Very well, I will tell you all about it. My name is Mentes. I am the son of a clever father, Anchialus, and I rule over a nation of seamen, the Taphians. I have come here now with a ship